Welcome and thank you for listening to the Web Talk Guys radio show. And my name is Rob Greenlee. If you're listening on the radio and you own an MP3 player or a pocket PC, you know you can take us on the road with you and listen anytime. Just go to our website and download our MP3 file from webtalkguys.com.
That's a good idea, Rob. Hey, I'm Web Girl Dana, and I'm always here to bring you the softer side of what's happening on the internet and the web, because I've got the female perspective.
Yes, and we respect that.
Thank you.
This week, we navigate the future of the net, from the slow disappearance of dial-up internet access to techies learning to speak business.
To some fun and useful websites we found online this week.
Yeah, some great ones.
We also now have a weblog at webtalkguys.blogger.com. Yeah, we jumped on the bandwagon.
And we joined the crowd.
This is where you can read about what happens to us, if you care, between the weekly shows we bring you. Our blog is also linked from webtalkguys.com, the front page there. This week we give tips and some links to some interesting resources like Rob's favorite, the atomic clock.
Yeah, get your computer synchronized to the atomic clock.
And then, the mystifying psychic crystal ball. This is an amazing mind puzzler. And I really kind of had this feeling that my browser was reading my mind. So check out the blog.
Go check it out, yeah. We have a very dynamic and fun guest on the show. We have the one and only Frank Catalano of Catalano Consulting, and he's a former tech editor for Seattle's Fox TV station, Q13. Frank will talk our ears off about tech stuff, but he also has some great insights on a fast-changing area of dial-up internet access. It is a gradual decline that's happening across the board as people move toward broadband internet access, and how this decline is starting to impact all of us and some of the biggest ISPs on the net.
For the last quarter, AOL actually saw a net loss of subscribers in the dial-up arena. That's got to be a little bit scary because, you know, when you're charging $24 a month for dial-up, that's a good amount of bread and butter. If you're trying to convert people now to basically bring their own access and still pay for your content, that's an iffy transition.
Geek speak has never been so important to our next guest on the show today. His name is Matthew Moran. He's an author of the soon-to-be-released book, IT Career Builder's Toolkit, the insider's guide to building your technology career in any economy. He's here to share some tips on how technologists can learn to speak business.
I think you can point to something like Saturday Night Live had that skit where they had the computer guy. It was funny because we knew computer people like that. If you're not careful, you are that person, and it's going to impact your career. And we can want executive management or the users to be more technical all we want, but we have to deal in the reality of the situation. And while it might be really interesting that you're upgrading servers and network routers, the fact is the manager or the user down the hall is only concerned that the message isn't leaving his outbox. He doesn't understand the optimization you're providing, as interesting as it might be. He really is only concerned with what his job is.
Rob, well, some fun and controversial news around the net this week. Madonna speaks volumes about online music privacy. What's that about?
Well, Madonna had a few choice words for music pirates out there this week. She was releasing her new album called American Life.
And a lot of people, including, I'm afraid to say, me, jumped on Kazaa to download it because we actually wanted to see the video. We wanted to hear the music.
And you got a surprise,
well,
didn't you?
Yes, yes. Madonna decided to have a little rant with some naughty words in there. And so you think you're downloading the actual music, and when you listen to it instead, it's Madonna saying, "What the
blank
do you think you're doing?" And she goes on and on.
The other thing that was fascinating about this was no advance copies were sent to journalists. So, you know, she's been really cutting down on the access to the song before its actual release onto the market, so she can cut down on any kind of pirating out there. But there's a bigger thing about this, too, is that Madonna's really flying contrary to even her record labels. I don't think a record label really wanted her to go to this extreme either. I also think that music should be something that's shared online, you know, as much as possible. I mean, I understand piracy is a big issue out there, and she deserves to earn money. But there's a big opportunity for her to use these peer-to-peer file-sharing networks to market her songs, I think. What do you think, Dana?
Oh, I agree. And I just want to clarify, Warner Music Group actually supports making a lot of their songs rentable or streaming mm-hmm. or downloadable as just a song, you know, or through places like Press Play or Rhapsody where you pay for that song. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case for Madonna's album at all. But yes, I definitely think that giving us a teaser or, you know, playing, I mean, we can watch videos all day long on MTV and VH1, mm-hmm. and that's all promotion, and the MTV doesn't pay for those videos. Yeah. And so why not also do the same with music and maybe just play half the song?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just put up a sample or just put up something. Yeah. And once you support these file sharing networks, maybe not give the full version, just like what we're saying here. But there's an opportunity, I think, for the music artist to take advantage of this.
But of course, you know what's really happening. Everybody's really excited about getting Madonna doing her rant.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Which is good. I mean, I have to give her credit for that because she stirred up a controversy in just putting out there her ranting about.
I do have to say, I did download the band video several weeks ago, so I'm glad to have that copy and I can't get it out of my mind. But
well, it's a good song. That's why.
Hey, Rob, before we go to the break, I wanted to just say a quick thank you to some of our new sponsors of the show coming up here in the next few weeks. Email newsletter service provider whatcounts.com. They're up in Seattle. David Geller, we appreciate very much your support of the show. And if any of you need an email newsletter or direct email service provider, well, they're really great. That's whatcounts.com. We also have MailWiper.com joining the sponsor ranks. It's a great spam filter plugin. We're users of MailWiper. It eliminates all the junk mail from our email box. Rob is a huge fan. I enjoy it too. And you can get it right now from the front page of WebTalkGuys.com.
It's a terrific little program, and it keeps getting better and better all the time.
We have a few more sponsors coming on board in the next few weeks. And the reason we're mentioning that is we'd really, really appreciate it if you would help us in supporting them. Because they're who are bringing this content to you for free. You can listen to entertaining content from WebTalkGuys on the go, thanks to these guys.
Yeah, we would really appreciate if you would support our sponsors, because they keep us on the air, as they say. Joining us in a moment is Frank Catalano of Catalano Consulting, and he's a former tech editor for Seattle Fox television station Q13, and he has some very insightful thoughts on the fast-changing area of dial-up internet access and its gradual decline as we all move towards broadband internet access. Frank is also joining the broadband ranks this weekend on Easter as he gets his new Comcast connection, so he's going to tell us about that too. So this is Web Talk Guys Radio.
Recognize that sound? If you're taking vitamins in a pill form, that's exactly where they're ending up. Hello, my name is Dr. David Friedman. According to the physician's desk reference, vitamins in a pill form are just 10% absorbed. So for every $100 you spend on vitamins, you are literally flushing $90 of it down the toilet. If you want to start absorbing the nutrients you swallow, you need to take a product called Sea Silver. Not only does it contain every vitamin, mineral, amino acid, and enzyme known to man, but because it's in a natural liquid form, it offers a 98% absorption. That means your body gets to keep the nutrients you swallow. Try delicious-tasting Sea Silver today. You'll feel a difference or your money back. Call 1-800-285-8963. That's 1-800-285-8963. Isn't it time you stopped flushing your vitamins down the toilet? 1-800-285-8963.
Welcome back to the Web Talk Guys Radio Show. My name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana. Hey, thanks, guys, for listening and sticking with us through the break. I want to make sure that you know you can check out our website at webtalkguys.com. Lots of great articles.
And go sign up for our newsletter.
That's right.
Get some terrific inside information. What's happening with the Web Talk Guys? On the line joining us today is Frank Catalano, who is a tech analyst for TV and radio at places like NPR and CNET. And he's also a writer and tech consultant for Catalano Consulting. That's his own company at catalanoconsulting.com. And he also has a blog out there. He's jumped on the blog bandwagon. And his blog is at bitemeonline.com. And he's got a newsletter or article that goes out every few weeks off of that site as well.
And that's something that he's been doing for a decade or more.
Yeah. And Frank Mike's been like on Q13 up in Seattle as a tech editor, and so he's been heavily involved in the technology area and is a highly renowned expert in this area. And the reason he's on the line with us today is that he recently wrote an interesting article about how the telco provider Quest.net, the dial-up ISP service, has been dropping a lot of their dial-up services and their customer service as well, which certainly is not new to Quest in general, but certainly rings an interesting bell for some major winds of change that are coming to the online access. And it's actually starting to change the direction of some of the biggest online ISPs and their services. Frank, thanks for joining us on the show and especially becoming a regular commentator for
us. My pleasure.
It's terrific. You just wrote an article about Quest.net's dial-up ISDN service and some of the issues you've been having with that. Why don't you give us kind of a rundown on that?
Well, it really has to do with a question of, is Quest really in the ISP business or is it pretending to be? And I think that is a fair question to ask these days, especially when it comes to dial-up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, out in the sticks where I have a home office, you can't get something like DSL or cable modems, at least not up until very, very recently. So anybody who wanted to get a high-speed internet connection had to go with ISDN, which basically is twice as fast as a 56K modem, but at about four times the cost.
Yeah, I used to have ISDN, too. It was expensive. I think I paid like $100 a month.
Yeah, it's about $120, including ISP service out here. And generally, it was pretty straightforward until some problems started cropping up this year, not with the ISDN physical phone line, but also with Quest.net's actual ISP service.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's been interesting is over a period of 3 months, several things have happened. One is they eliminated worldwide roaming, which allowed you to basically go overseas or any place and dial in using your account. They replaced it with a free, more limited service, but somehow forgot to tell the billing department that.
Hmm.
And kept charging for months the same amount of money for worldwide roaming, a service that no longer exists. And it's been taking about a call every month to try to get that taken off my bill.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
That's one thing. So I kept wondering about the communication issues there with Quest.net. Second thing that's happened is when they did this process, they apparently eliminated my and a whole bunch of other people's user IDs and passwords.
Oh, no.
So we couldn't use our ISDN service because they just all went away. And I had to call tech support, and they said, Yeah, somehow the ISP part of our business decided to wipe that out when they were updating the system.
Wonderful.
And I wouldn't have known that unless I'd thought to call tech support versus just having it happen to me. The third thing that has happened, between there are those two factors and, well, let's just say there's a lot of little things that have been happening with Quest.net's dial-up service for ISDN that makes one wonder, first off, is Quest really want to be in this business? And secondly, if they don't want to be in this business, why don't they just tell people that as opposed to having them suffer, as I have? Now, it's pretty obvious that Quest does not want to be in the consumer ISP business
mm-hmm.
because they ceded that a couple of years back to MSN. But that's been beset by an awful lot of transition problems for their customers on the consumer side.
Mm-hmm.
On the business side, though, it looks like they're slowly but surely at least de-emphasizing ISDN dial-up and other dial-up aspects in favor of broadband.
Yeah, I can see that, especially with their DSL solutions that they're pushing out there. And I think they're even aligned with the MSN folks on that now, aren't they?
They are for the consumer DSL. I know that mm-hmm. for a fact. And again, this is just speculation on my part as to whether or not they want to stay in the ISP business. But they certainly aren't making a friend out of me.
No, I would think not.
In this way. And for example, one of the things that also has been happening was an intermittent problem of the type where you'd be online for a little bit and then suddenly your connection would go stale.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you'd show as being connected, but you couldn't check email, you couldn't go anywhere on the internet, you couldn't visit any websites. And it took a period of, 12 days of phone calls, 6 hours on the phone over those 12 days. They had me do everything on my end, including troubleshooting the connection, rebooting the computer, resetting the ISDN terminal adapter. I won't bore you with it, but just say every bonehead computing 101 thing that you hear about in tech support horror stories, they had me do. Nothing helped. All it did was raise my blood pressure, waste their time, and waste my time. And suddenly after 12 days, the problem cleared up on its own. at the very beginning, I said it's probably a problem in one of your, you know, network centers where you have a connection that's going bad on a modem. A modem that's going bad, or a modem pool that's having a switching problem. And they said, oh, no, no, sir, please do all these things. So I did, and it turns out it went away after 12 days, which leads me to believe they finally checked their own network.
Yeah, they finally got to it. Needless to say, you're probably looking at moving beyond ISDN service sometime soon here, huh?
Well, let's just say that I am not unhappy that Comcast finally decided to put in a cable modem service in my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
That just started mere days ago, and I have seen the Comcast trucks out here like swarms of ants on honey at various households installing it, and I'm in the queue.
Yeah, that's terrific. Good news.
Frank's out there throwing daffodils in the way, you know, in the way. Greeting them.
Actually, I'm putting up signs saying free pizza and beer for Comcast employees in my yard.
Come on over, right? Yeah. Hey, are these problems with Quest, do you think, a problem that's permeating the whole telecom industry right now?
Well, you know, the telecom industry does not get any points for customer friendliness.
If
you go back years and years to the old AT&T monopoly when it was called Ma Bell, you might recall there were bumper stickers that said, "We don't care. We don't have to. AT&T." And that type of sort of, I would call it clueless arrogance is the way I would look at it, went from AT&T to AOL for several years, and they say they're trying to fix their problems with customer service and customer relations.
Yeah.
It's gone to Quest, I think, for good or ill. It just seems to be something that sits in the telecommunications industry.
Yeah.
And I think it's because the telecom comes out of monopoly mentality,
mm-hmm.
where they don't have to worry about customer service, and it hasn't been deregulated long enough where they're sort of out of that mentality. Inevitably, with every phone call I've made to telecommunications companies with problems, from AT&T to AOL to Quest to lots of others, mm-hmm. they are unfailingly polite and utterly useless. The problem is never resolved, but they try to make you feel good about it.
Now, with the growth of broadband, though, you would think that there'd be a lot more pressure on Quest and AOL and the MSN folks to get their act together to compete. But is it a futile effort at this point with the growth of broadband?
I think part of it is, a traditional problem in these organizations. They're not necessarily set up
mm-hmm.
to respond quickly to consumer input.
Yeah.
And this doesn't mean that there are, there's some Dr. Evil master at the top of the telecom company saying be nasty to customers.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of an issue of these are entrenched bureaucracies with certain ways of doing things. And they're used to operating in a heavily regulated environment. And many of these areas still are heavily regulated.
Yeah.
You have, some telecom services within the same company, which are deregulated and totally free market, and others which are still heavily regulated monopolies. And with that in mind, what tends to happen is, I think, the lowest common denominator bureaucracy rules.
Yeah.
So these organizations seem to be structurally incapable of responding quickly to the consumer and to a consumer's needs, even if some individuals in the company, even very high up, want them to.
Well, that doesn't bode well for the future of those companies, does it?
Well, as long as telecom companies keep hiring executives from other telecom companies, it doesn't bode well.
Mm-hmm.
And hiring, key positions. But as time goes on and the Ma Bell monopoly becomes more and more of a memory, and local phone service monopolies start to become a little bit more of a memory, you might get more flexible customer service, better response. The downside, of course, that is, too, is you could wind up with a situation where companies become so free market and become so responsive, say, to what they think the customer wants, is they're not very sound companies. And to show how that can go really bad, look at another old monopoly represented by Enron.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's true. Now, Comcast is sitting in a fascinating position with this and all the other cable ISP providers to offer telephone service and internet service and television service, obviously, with what they're doing now. They could easily come in and replace a Quest, seems like.
Yeah, they could. And, there are a number of companies that are working both sides of the aisle, if you will. You have companies that are offering telephone service to the cable network providers
mm-hmm.
so that they can offer sort of the full meal deal, cable TV, high-speed internet, and voice. On the flip side, you have companies such as Mirio, which are offering television services to the telephone companies, so they can offer that over DSL-type lines, as well as high-speed internet and their traditional voice. The thing is, you really have two completely different business cultures.
Yeah, you do.
And that's where the disconnect occurs. Just because the plumbing can handle the business doesn't mean the business model is understood by those who own the plumbing.
Yeah, and it just doesn't make sense that TV could be effectively transmitted over a DSL connection. It just doesn't have the bandwidth.
No, but there are some companies that are effectively providing that kind of service, strangely
really?
Enough. Yeah.
Interesting. I hadn't heard about that.
But the problem you have there isn't as much as the technical infrastructure, and the technical infrastructure is an issue, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But a bigger issue, quite frankly, is the business culture and the business models. And also, which type of monopoly is a consumer less or more likely to feel warm and fuzzy about?
Yeah.
I mean, who do you like less, your cable provider or your phone company?
Cable provider, definitely.
Okay, you like them more? So
yeah.
That might account, for example, why Comcast is doing bang-up business with cable modem. And while cable modems have a much higher penetration in this country than DSL do for broadband.
Mm-hmm. Plus, actually faster connections, too. So you can get a 2 meg per second connection with a cable modem, but you can't get that with DSL.
Well, and DSL also was off to a very bad start in the U.S. There were so many regulatory hurdles and so many installation problems, much of it brought on by the baby bells themselves. So as a result, cable modems seem a heck of a lot easier and more straightforward to install.
Yeah,
and so they got a leg up.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the changes that are happening because of this transition over from dial-up to broadband, and what that's going to do to companies like AOL and the MSN folks, because they've been banking their whole revenue stream off of dial-up service, and if that dial-up service goes away and they don't convert those people over to broadband connections, isn't their business model going to get undermined in the long run?
Well, I think AOL already realizes that, and Microsoft certainly does with MSN.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for the last quarter, AOL actually saw a net loss of subscribers in the dial-up arena.
Yeah.
And that is, that's got to be a little bit scary.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you're charging $24 a month for dial-up, that's a good amount of bread and butter. And if you're trying to convert people now to basically bring their own access and still pay for your content, that's an iffy transition. Now, the market dynamics and the market forces are different now than, say, 4 years from now, 4 years ago. Three to 4 years ago, everybody expected all content on the Internet to be free.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only a few rare exceptions. Wall Street Journal Online Edition was a rare exception. People were willing to pay for that. Porn sites. You know,
well, that's still out there.
That was a rare exception. That was a content model that worked.
Yeah,
and there wasn't a hell of a lot between the gray button up and the all buttoned off extremes of this.
Yeah.
But what's happened, of course, over the last year or two is that more and more sites are successfully charging for content because a lot of the free alternatives, which were based on eyeball advertising revenue models, went under.
Yeah.
So there aren't as many options, especially for unique types of branded content. That said, that kind of opens the way for MSN with any exclusive content it has and AOL with any exclusive content it has to charge for that content.
Yeah.
The problem is it's going to be twofold for both of those services. One is, what's the right amount of money to charge? If somebody's already on broadband, what's the right amount to charge?
Yeah, I can see a scenario where you know, a Comcast subscriber is trying to access content on the Internet, and it's more of an unobstructed access to the World Wide Web, which means that you're using a regular browser. You're not using a proprietary browser like through AOL. You're able to go wherever you want to go. You don't have to be confined to AOL content. And that's going to open up the eyes to a lot of people out there. They're going to say, well, I don't need America Online. I don't need the MSN service. I can pick from Yahoo. I can go directly to a site that I want to use.
Well, but of course, that's just one piece of it, is how much do they charge? Now, if they choose to charge $4.95 a month for everything on AOL,
Then
that's a more interesting value proposition. Not that that's what they're going to do, but they could. The magic number is probably under $10 a month. The second piece of it, though, is much harder, I think, for AOL and MSN.
Mm-hmm.
They are so closely identified in the consumer's mind as ISPs.
Exactly.
Ch- changing that public brand image from ISP to great place to go for cool content is really hard.
Yeah.
This is a problem that Yahoo, for example, does not have.
Mm-hmm.
Yahoo has successfully instituted a whole number of new fee-based paid services,
yeah.
including the Yahoo Platinum video streaming service and a whole bunch of other high-end services.
Yeah.
The thing is, Yahoo never had the baggage of having really been an ISP.
Exactly.
Sure, they partnered with SBC for ISP services, but there was never a Yahoo dial-up number that you would call in like there is with AOL or MSN.
Yeah, yeah. Now I think they're sitting in a good position to capitalize on that because they've already built their model that's profitable right now. And going forward, they're probably sitting in the best position of anybody right now, I would think.
And you also have, of course, Real Networks, which has gone from being simply a place where you download free player software
mm-hmm.
into a place where you can subscribe
mm-hmm.
to the Gold Pass and the Super Pass and other aspects of the subscription service. If that's the model that AOL and say, MSN wishes to emulate, part of the challenge is going to be is will it still be AOL or MSN?
Yeah.
Because if you look at Yahoo, you don't pay one fee for all the Yahoo premium services.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and also let's throw into the mix here Google. They're a fascinating play. Yahoo separated themselves from Google, and Google's getting such a brand out there that they could probably become a content area, and I think that's what they're trying to become here.
Well, in some respects, they've kind of moved into that with their purchase of Pyra.
Yeah.
Pyra basically owns and runs the Blogger weblog
mm-hmm.
service,
mm-hmm.
and there are actually a couple of paid parts to Blogger, now owned by Google. There's Blogspot Pro, which is a hosting service for weblogs, and there is also a Blogger Pro, which is a higher functional version of their weblog authoring software, Blogger. And so through the acquisition, basically, Google is now actually in the paid services arena with Blogger Pro and Blogspot Pro through Pyra.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's easy for them to expand. So what you really got to look at, though, is when you think of AOL, what do you think of in terms of content? I don't think that's a question anybody can answer.
Well, and it's usually outsourced content. It's content that's available out of the AOL service as well.
Yes, and MSN. Same situation. Now, you might be able to say, okay, CarPoint and a few other things that Microsoft owns outright are
mm-hmm.
part of MSN. But quite frankly, I think when most people think of MSN, they think of either it being an ISP or they think of Hotmail.
Exactly.
And I think where Yahoo has been successful, where Real Networks is being successful, where Google might be successful, is they have established separate brands that you know what they are, you know what you're buying. You
mm-hmm.
can get a clear mental image of it. AOL, right now, your mental image is, it's an ISP. I don't need an ISP anymore, but I'd like some other content. What is AOL's content? Same
mm-hmm.
thing with most of MSN. Now, AOL is moving in the right direction, I think, in some respects, by leveraging their Time Warner relationship and ownership to go ahead and take a lot of the Time Warner magazines and make them exclusively on AOL and off the free web.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at AOL as being basically a magazine hub, and you pay a certain amount of money to get access to that, that's one direction they could go.
Yeah.
The problem is it's still wrapped up with everything else that they offer.
I mean, well, certainly AOL has access to Time Warner, which has a lot of properties that can be funneled into a proprietary interface or subscription model through AOL, and that could be a way that they could capitalize on that content moving forward, especially as it moves into the broadband era where they can actually tap into that video and cartoons or whatever content that they want to put into that.
Well, I think AOL is going to find itself and already find itself in the awkward position of having to essentially create a two-tiered service.
Yeah.
The first tier is for newbies,
mm-hmm.
the people who basically don't know what they want on the Internet. They want a single service so they can use as an ISP and as a content source.
Yeah.
And that's where AOL's strength traditionally has been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The second tier is a place where experienced users go. And, you know, it doesn't take more than a year or two for a newbie to become an experienced user.
Yeah.
And that's when they decide, oh, I don't want that AOL.com email address. I don't want to be tied to their proprietary software. I'll go elsewhere. And it's those people who AOL now needs how to figure out how they're going to appeal to them with their content. They still
mm-hmm.
may want AOL content, but they may not want the AOL service, per se.
Mm-hmm. Frank, what's your thought right now? If you look at the players and how they're positioned right now, who do you think is the leader in that and is ultimately going to gather the most audience?
In terms of essentially paid services?
Yeah, exactly. Being able to convert those dial-up customers into a paid content model, which is really what we're talking about here.
Well, I think Yahoo right now, despite a number of their lapses, which I have discussed with you.
Yeah, that's true.
In terms of privacy policy, I think Yahoo is probably heading in the right direction.
Yeah, I think Google
will make some very smart moves in the near future. I have no inside knowledge, but it just they just strike me as that kind of company.
Yeah.
I also think that MSN is much more likely to figure this out sooner than AOL. I really think AOL...
Why do you think that that they're in a better position than AOL to get this figured out?
Only because Microsoft has a lot of really smart people willing to throw a lot of money at making something work. And Microsoft never gives up after the first iteration. They do a second, third, fourth iteration until they finally think they have it right. AOL, unfortunately, suffers from the fact that it's the 800-pound gorilla.
Yeah.
You know, if you're the 800-pound gorilla, as long as, you know, the jungle hasn't changed much, you can pretty much pound everything else into submission.
Yeah,
but, man, once you got to get up and start moving and figuring out where the pack is going, you're slow.
Yeah, well, and they are slow to react, I think, here, even today up till this moment. Let's also talk about how the disappearance of dial-up is going to affect millions of people out there that may be outside of the range of being able to get cable service. You know, I know that that was one of your concerns in your article was that there's going to be a lot of people that are just going to lose access if dial-up service goes away. What's your thought on that?
I don't know if dial-up service is ever going to completely go away, but there certainly is a perception that it is going away. My father, who is in his 70s, recently called me to say, you know, I'd like to sign up for Earthlink or for some of these other companies, providers, but none of them seem to offer dial-up anymore. They're always advertising DSL or cable. And does this mean anybody offers broadband? And so there is a perception among anybody offers dial-up, I should say. There is a perception among some people that, based just simply on the marketing efforts of the ISPs, that dial-up is no longer even out there anymore.
Because
it's not what's being promoted.
Exactly.
So it could become, in some respects, a self-fulfilling prophecy where people assume that broadband is the only way to go for a connection. That if they live in an area which has broadband, that's all they get, which, you know, makes some sense.
Yeah.
But then that suddenly leaves dial-up out there as the analog cell phone of Internet service. Still pretty ubiquitous, still usable, even though slow, still reliable, but not the cash cow it once was. So I think it will continue to hang on, much as analog cell phone service has in many areas of the country, but just won't be sexy or, for that matter, even necessarily very cheap going forward.
Yeah, and there are certainly other alternatives, too. There's satellite, direct PC type things, and even Wi-Fi type of solutions that may be coming down the line, too. What's your thoughts on those?
Well, I think the Wi-Fi solution is a lot more problematic still because it does still require other type of Internet infrastructure at the back end. You know, you can't basically have a, or you don't right now, have basically a pure Wi-Fi Internet network. It connects to something wired at some point.
Yeah.
So I think that's often the future, and it's probably going to be pretty much a business solution and an enthusiast solution for a while.
Well, it's spotty right now. I mean, there's a lot of hotspots going into like retail type environments, like Starbucks and those kind of things. But it seems like it's going to spread very slowly because nobody's really got a handle on it. I mean, I think that the only network that I can think of that seems to be moving in an organized way is the T-Mobile folks.
Yeah, and that's you know, pretty much an attempt to keep Wi-Fi from preempting the whole cellular phone network. You know, they don't want to lose that revenue stream. They want people to basically think of T-Mobile as the place to go for any kind of wireless connection, whether it's your PC or your telephone.
Well, and that's a good strategy, I think.
I think it's a brilliant strategy, and I really think that the people who will win in Wi-Fi are existing service providers who can add it as an additional feature. As far as satellite goes, I think the time of satellite Internet access has come and gone. I honestly think that for most mainstream consumers, it has just proven to be too problematic for them because it has traditionally required some kind of a phone uplink. you know, to basically transmit the request.
Yeah.
And it's really fast on what you receive and really slow going the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think satellite is a great solution, except maybe for the people in rural areas who want broadband and only yeah. have dial-up as an option.
Mm-hmm.
As far as other solutions that are out there, you know, I'm sure we'll be surprised. I'm sure somebody will come up with ways to really push the envelope of even some of the existing DSL and cable technologies out there. I mean, there are other flavors of DSL that aren't deployed right now that are much faster than what we have.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's, you know, it's fascinating to see what the future could hold with all this because, you know, it's going to have a dramatic impact on everybody's life. How to get access, you know, people carrying around pocket PCs and they're carrying around these wireless devices and being able to connect up to a nationwide wireless network. And I think that there's some technology that's being worked on to make available wireless internet access beaming from the satellites. So have you heard of any technologies like that coming down the line?
Wireless internet access from a satellite, yes. I have heard of some of that. I don't have many details on
yeah.
that at hand. I do know that, you know, if you think about it, it seems pretty straightforward to do. If you look at things like XM satellite radio.
Exactly. It's the same kind of a model, I would think.
Right, because the antenna doesn't have to be very big. The real issue is the uplink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's how do you get that request going? And that can be done using a 3G network or even just a standard cellular network.
Yeah, that is true. Well, Frank, thanks for joining us on the show.
My pleasure. And I want to say to all the fine folks at Quest that I really do like you, and you do offer a great service. It's just that you got a few kinks to work out in Quest.net. Don't forget those of us who live out in the sticks, please.
Well, and we should be clear, your comments aren't in relation to the Quest Wireless or any of those other divisions of Quest, right?
No, right. Quest as a long-distance service provider, Quest as a local phone company, Quest as a wireless company, they're all fine. Quest.net, eh. Work on it, people.
Well, you know, it was just their turn, right?
It was their turn. And the mantle has been passed from AT&T to AOL to Quest, and Quest.net wears it proudly, I'm pleased to say.
Okay, who's next?
You know, there's just so many choices out there.
Yes, there are right now, aren't there? Well, Frank, I appreciate your input and your knowledge on all this. It was fascinating. We'll have to keep talking, right?
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Frank Catalano, who is a tech analyst for TV and radio at places like NPR and CNET, and he's also a writer and tech consultant at Catalano Consulting at catalanoconsulting.com, and definitely go check out his blog at bitemeonline.com and sign up for his article newsletter that he has off of that site as well.
Now hang tight and stay connected because you don't want to miss this next segment as we learn why technologists need to learn how to speak business. This is a must listen to. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
Recognize that sound? If you're taking vitamins in a pill form, that's exactly where they're ending up. Hello, my name is Dr. David Friedman. According to the physician's desk reference, vitamins in a pill form are just 10% absorbed. So for every $100 you spend on vitamins, you are literally flushing $90 of it down the toilet. If you want to start absorbing the nutrients you swallow, you need to take a product called Sea Silver. Not only does it contain every vitamin, mineral, amino acid, and enzyme known to man, but because it's in a natural liquid form, it offers a 98% absorption. That means your body gets to keep the nutrients you swallow. Try delicious-tasting Sea Silver today. You'll feel a difference or your money back. Call 1-800-285-8963. That's 1-800-285-8963. Isn't it time you stopped flushing your vitamins down the toilet? 1-800-285-8963.
Web Talk Guys, downloading
Web Talk Guys.
You're back connected to the Web Talk Guys radio show, and thanks for listening. My name is Rob Greenlee.
And I'm Web Girl Dana. Well, Rob, you know the term, the Great Divide. Well, I think that if you've ever worked for a business that has an IT department, you really could apply that concept of the Great Divide that divides upper management and the information technology department, the IT department, and how they relate to each other. It's like they're from a different planet. You've probably seen that in some of the companies you worked for, right, Rob?
Yeah, it's not a pretty relationship. There is a critical need for technologists to understand and communicate with business management, and more often than not, there is a divide.
Yeah, our guest today believes that the gap can be bridged, and he's going to give us some tips on how technologists can learn to speak business.
Matthew Moran is joining us, and he's been a technology professional for 14 years. He's also a consultant that provides career development, workshops, and counseling. And he's also an author of the soon-to-be-released IT Career Builders Toolkit, the insider's guide to building your technology career in any economy. He's on the phone with us today to talk about why technology people need to start speaking business. Matt, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
What do you mean by the technologist must learn to speak business? What are you trying to say with that?
Traditionally, and almost stereotypically, technologists are a little bit myopic in their view of what they're doing. And they really, when they speak to their management and when they speak really to users, they come across as kind of geeky. We want to be out front and open, and mm-hmm. I'm the first to say I'm one of those guys. But they often do not or fail to communicate the true business benefit of what they do, sometimes because just of semantic problems. They don't communicate that way. They have not been taught to do that. And other times because they don't see it. They just don't understand.
Well, is it also that the management side of it doesn't really understand, and there's a fundamental disconnect in the language and the understanding, it seems?
Well, yeah, I point that out in I have a workshop titled by the same name, Why Technologists Must Learn to Speak Business. And I point out that executive management for a long time has complained that their technology professionals seem to hide behind technical jargon, and in many cases, IT management has been brought up from IT staff, and so they're very good at communicating with their staff technically, but they are not as effective as teaching their staff and themselves speaking to executive management.
So you're saying it's more the responsibility of the IT professional to take that communication role than it is for the staff or the management side to come to their side a little bit more?
Absolutely, and I think that's critical to understand. I would say the same thing to an accounting professional or to any what we will call a technically skilled professional, and I don't mean technically bits and bytes, but technically in any venue. I think we can use the analogy of a good doctor. When you go to your doctor, when he comes back and he starts speaking to you in Latin terminology and gives you the chemical derivatives of things, you're lost.
Yeah.
He needs to speak to you on some term that you can understand. He needs to control his desire to, utilize all that well-earned knowledge from college and start speaking to you on things you understand, because you are ultimately the person that he's solving that problem for. I can't put the burden on the CEO or executive management. They're really in charge of vision direction. They do not have to learn the ins and outs of all the marketing language. They shouldn't even speak on those terms. They need to provide large direction and vision for the company, and it's really the responsibility of the technologist to control and learn how to communicate effectively with management or with the user population in a way they understand.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of fights or squabbles or struggles that happen within a lot of corporations, I think, in this area, because I think it gets into a kind of a control thing, because the IT professional controls all the information and thinks that they have the central nervous system for the organization and should be involved in a lot of stuff. What's your thought on examples of how there's been conflict in communication, and what have you seen?
I had a integration and consulting company, and we did a lot of work. At one point, we were doing work for Northrop Grumman.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, for 4 weeks of work, it would take us 5 months of political maneuvering to make things happen. And that's because mm-hmm. several engineering/technology departments controlled their little fiefdom. So it's definitely an issue. I think you can point to something like Saturday Night Live had that skit where they had the computer guy. I can't remember his name exactly.
Yeah, I remember. That was really funny.
It was funny. It was funny because we knew computer people like that.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. while the parody is funny and while the kind of this Dilbertized caricature is interesting, if you're not careful, you are that person, and it's going to impact your career. And we can want executive management or the users to be more technical all we want, but one of the things I convey in my career counseling is we can want all sorts of things, but we have to deal in the reality of the situation. And while it might be really interesting that you're upgrading servers and network routers, the fact is the manager or the user down the hall is only concerned that the message isn't leaving his outbox.
Yeah.
And that's
exactly
where you meet him, because he doesn't understand the optimization you're providing, as interesting as it might be. He really is only concerned with what his job is.
To kind of add to that, the IT manager, at least my experience, is that they see their network as really the center of the company, and that they're really almost the gatekeeper of information on there. And that even includes like website design. And I think that the IT department has a tendency to get into a lot of areas within the organization that maybe they shouldn't be. What's your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. It's interesting. I did work for Sebastian Haircare based out of Los Angeles, owned by Wella Corporation. And at one point, the IT manager was gone, and I was there as their technical infrastructure specialist, consulting mm-hmm. with them. And we went into his office and had to get some cables that were made up. And this is how kind of bizarre the situation got. We got these cables because we had to patch a group of 10 users who were being moved to a new area. And we took care of that. And the next day, I was literally accosted in the hallway by the manager stating, "I took his cable."
Oh, no.
And now, I'm a consultant. I'm external. And, you know, I was able to control myself as much as, you know, he's pointing his finger at me. And I, you know, the urge was there to kind of snap it off, I guess. But I controlled myself. And I said, "Please understand, my perception is that those cables were Wella Corporation and belonged to the technical infrastructure of the company. And they were used for that purpose, which is appropriate.
Yeah.
However, if you have an issue, please go to the CFO who I was reporting to."
Yeah.
The situation was ultimately diffused, but it was kind of this, you know, it really brought to light this idea of my technology department is my stuff.
Exactly.
And it's not your stuff. And as much as when I consult with people, what is ultimately developed is their stuff. It's not my stuff. It's ultimately the what I've developed while working for a given company, application development-wise, is ultimately their product. I'm working for them.
Mm-hmm. You know, from an experience standpoint, they basically want to dictate to you your permissions and what you can do on your PC. Because in a lot of ways, if you make a mistake or you crash something, they have to come back and actually fix it for you. So I think you have this whole vested interest because of their time and effort in like your workstation.
Well, and part of that comes to, you know, a training issue. I'm a big advocate of thin client computing, and I was doing Citrix back in 96. That's Sebastian when it was a large Citrix project, and I spoke at PC Expo on thin client computing 2 years in a row out in New York. And I am no stranger to that dilemma. As a matter of fact, I believe in a controlled and structured environment.
Mm-hmm.
However, controlled and structured means we're meeting all the needs of those users. On the same token, when we control something through permissions, through profiles, whatever the case may be, and deny access somewhere, we need to convey to them the reason we do that. And you know, when you control it in terms of this is a business function and we are trying to make sure that things run as smoothly as possible and our time is used as effectively, so we control these things. If you need a change, go through the proper channels and we will make every effort to do that. The users and, you know, kind of everybody involved tends to go, "Okay, I understand that. I know why that's being done," as opposed to having technology done to them.
Yeah.
And there's a difference. You don't want to do technology to people. You want to provide them with the tools they need, and technology is just the tool to help you do that.
I'm actually curious, Matt, since you mentioned that IT guys need to make the communication effort with management as opposed to the other way around, and you also give workshops on career building and finding the jobs in IT. What is your advice to an IT guy that was looking for, or girl, that was looking for a job and had an interview with someone, you know, with the acronym C-something, you know, a CEO or the CFO or the CIO? how would they best do that interview so they don't come across sounding like the guy in the Saturday Night Live skit?
One of the things I advocate very strongly is kind of a diversity of, you know, both your professional contacts. A lot of times technologists are kind of incestuous in that they only relate and hang out with other technologists because, hey, you know, you hang out with the people that have the same interest as you. And, you know, when I'm speaking a lot of times to technologists, I kind of jokingly will tell them, listen, if you don't have a personality, go buy one. You know, you need to get one. But what I really try and advocate is, you know, technology is okay, and I can talk bits and bytes and you know, configurations and how exciting that project is, but you need to create a broader general interest conversation set. And so you do that through exposing yourself to the people at the company that will help you develop those skills. So to a budding technologist, I would say find some mentors that are not technologists, some people that you discuss business with, general understanding. Maybe you meet up with the marketing guy. At Sebastian, the marketing director became a close friend of mine, and the information I pulled from him was tremendous. And he would teach me about marketing and what they're doing, and I got involved in what their product was. And that's kind of the, you know, I just posted an article recently, and I gave a list of reading material. And in the reading material, I said, you know, notice that I'm reading 7-8 to 1 non-technology to technology related material. Mm. So I'm reading 7 Habits by Stephen Covey, or Winning the Talent Wars by Bruce Tolgan, or The Roaring 2000s by Harry Dent, Dangerous Company by O'Shea and Madigan, Running Training Like a Business, The Goal by Eliyahu Goldratt, which covers manufacturing. And so I'm trying to get as much broad information as possible for two reasons. One, it interests me. But the other is then in general conversation, I'm speaking to them on their terms. They go, wow, this person gets what we're doing as a business. And on the flip side, they know this technology. What a powerful combination. If I can, I'll point out, eWeek just had an article, literally went up on the 14th, called Bridging the Gap. And it's talking, I'll read the intro, and you tell me what this is saying.
Mm-hmm.
What do you call an employee who works with the company's top brass to define a business problem, collaborates with the departmental staff to hammer out the requirement, and helps the IT crew determine the best technology to use to solve it? Increasingly, this employee is likely to be tagged IT business technologist or IT business analyst. But whatever the official title, these workers are also called in demand.
That's right. Yeah. And a new job title to boot.
I saw this and I wrote the writer and I said, gosh, you are saying what I've been saying for a long time. And I'm not the only person who's identified this. One of the books I mentioned, Running Training Like a Business, is doing for training and development what I'm trying to do for technology, which is we have this highly technical skill and technical aptitude, but if we don't model it under some business context, it really does nothing for us. It solves no problem. We need to think in terms of business solutions. With my integration company, I used to tell my consultants that if what this company needs, what our client needs is a pad of paper and a pencil, then that's what we're going to sell them. And so, not that I hope that's what they wanted or needed, but the fact is we don't define what they need by technology. Their need defines our technology. Mm-hmm. It's really the other way around.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of been my observation that I think over the years, especially when it applies to like webmasters, that there's been so much of a demand on their skills and their learning. And what you're talking about here, is this really maybe potentially pushing people beyond their capabilities just because it requires a different type of thought process to integrate business into technology thinking? And are we stretching, you know, the employees within that organization to be more than probably what's reasonable for them to be?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because You're hitting on a point that I think is very relevant to the technologist, and there's almost this fear of becoming obsolete. And this fear of becoming obsolete is because technology is changing so rapidly, there's this driving need to stay up to date on the technology. So how do you have time to do these other pursuits, to become more well-rounded, if you're just driving to learn the technology?
Well, and to actually keep up and to keep up with all your projects and things, too.
Well, and one of the things that, you know, I work a lot with our kids in education, and so, you know, I'm always telling my children as we get ready for an exam, don't study what you know, study what you don't know. And what I mean by that is a lot of people, and we'll relate to technologists, they cram to learn a new technology, and so they read a book on that technology top to bottom. But the fact is, most technology isn't that big of a change from the technology 2 years ago. There's new tools, certainly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when they have to read an entire book and really think they need to absorb all of that, they're kind of cramming too much into their brain. There's a lot of overlap between those technologies. So they could probably transfer some of that knowledge conceptually and then just adopt kind of the new semantics, some of the new tools at their disposal. But the fact is, you know, is NetWare that different than Windows NT at its core function, what it's doing? Well, no. Users, permissions, groups, access to files, that's the same. So we don't have to myopically think of any of those things. That's the same regardless of the platform you're on. So let's get to the semantic differences. And I approach this strong belief that if you learn good conceptual knowledge on solutions, like you can frame a solution, the technology is actually easier to use because you begin to structure your learning and see opportunities in that learning where you're going, oh, I could use that here to solve that problem, as opposed to learning how to make a message box come up that says, hello, world. That's not really relevant to what you're doing. You need to go through that, but the fact is, I always tell people that I programmed in XBase and some RPG, you know, ages gone by. It's the same as Windows.net. Now, of course, there's these Windows.net experts that are saying, no way, you're completely wrong. I would tell I spoke in November to a group of AS400 professionals, and I said, you know, an AS400 is really just like a Windows 98 PC. It's no different. And, of course, you know, it was like stabbing them in the heart. And then I explained, not in functionally how much power it has, but the fact is, gosh, it has an OS, there's hardware, it has memory, it has data that's stored on it, and the name of the game is getting the data off in an effective manner and storing it in an effective manner. And using that as a core, while it seems simplistic, helps you learn and adopt new technologies with far less stress.
Seems like there's kind of two worlds here. There's a small company, you know, network and IT development, and then we have the major corporations. And I think the major corporations typically have like project managers that run in between those technologists and management. What's the different environments, and what can a technologist do in those different environments?
One of the things, first of all, that I strongly advocate for technologists is not to, first of all, view themselves as, how can I put it, as a particular type of technologist. Don't kind of become focused as, I'm a COBOL programmer, I'm a VB programmer. Instead say, you know, and I want them not just to say this, it's not just kind of, you know, slick PR, I want them to think this way. I'm a technology professional,
Yeah. Okay,
and this is my tool. Now, when you take it into these large environments, one of the things that I strongly advocate for any technology professional is to try and make a bridge in your career where you are not working for a traditional IT department. And for a lot of technologists, they define themselves as having to work within an IT group. I advocate very strongly that if you can work to become a business analyst, even in a clerical capacity early on in your career, that you stand to learn a lot more about adopting these business skills. And the reason, you know, the reason it's important is most of these business skills and communication skills are completely transcendent. The same communication skills that would have helped you in 1970 and 1960 and 1840 are very likely the same skills and aptitudes you're going to need today. And so if you learn those skills early on, then you can focus much more on the technology and still keep those skills with you. Because once they're with you, they're very transcendent. Technology skills are not as transcendent. And it removes the stress of going, am I relevant now, you know, now that I don't have the most recent skills? If you have this business knowledge and acumen, businesses will go to you and say, you know, we'll hire you and train you the technology because, gosh, you have this other skill set that we can't find.
Matt, without a doubt, you've got a ton of advice for IT workers out there. And actually, you've put all that into a book called the IT Career Builders Toolkit. Tell us about your book, when it'll be available, where we can get it, and mention, too, that you have that newsletter that you that people can sign up for.
Okay. The IT Career Builders Toolkit, the full title is the IT Career Builders Toolkit, The Insider's Guide to Building Your Technology Career in Any Economy. And I was very specific on that. It's available, first of all, it's going to be the next revision of it's going to be available, I believe, starting tomorrow. And you, there's two places you're going to be able to go to it. One is with a company you've interviewed before, techies.com, and the other is on my website at www.cbtoolkit.com. And the Notes from the Toolshed is a little mini newsletter that's going to come out biweekly. Several have been produced, but it's going to start coming out from both techies.com and from my website. And it really is more of a quick look at some recent news items with a little editorial commentary from me that just gives you, what does this really mean to your career? Are there things you have to change or modify or think about in terms of this recent event? Maybe it's the war, maybe it's some economic event. And then there's a little piece of career advice. And the newsletter, that's free. It's just something you have to register for and go online and you can get that.
And again, your website is?
www.cbtoolkit.com.
Excellent.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us, Matt.
Thank you very much.
It was great having you on the show.
All right.
We've been speaking with Matthew Morin, a tech consultant, workshop leader, and author of a soon-to-be-released IT Career Builders Toolkit, The Insider's Guide to Building Your Technology Career in Any Economy. His website is cbtoolkit.com.
Well, Rob, that's it for this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to our show once again.
Yeah, thank you to everybody.
We enjoyed bringing it to you. We'll have another great show for you next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys station.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.